Well, today we're starting a new series. We're calling it The Wars of the Lord, and we hope that these are inspiring and cautionary tales about life's challenges. You know, we're all in spiritual warfare every day, and so when we're reading about the wars of the Lord in Scripture, these are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come, and that's the way the Bible reads. And so when we're looking at the story of the Red Sea, the parting of the Red Sea for the children of Israel, we're looking at something about our own lives. So here's the story. You know it well. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes and see there, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sorely afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you. You shall hold your peace." And the angel of the Lord, angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went before their face and stood behind them. Came between the camp of the Egyptians, the camp of Israel. It was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all the night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. The children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon dry ground. The waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, all of those, repeat. And Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea. The Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. There remained not so much as one of them, but the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right and left. Well, you can see that in chapter 15, this causes a wonderful celebration song. So skipping to the middle there, Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord. "I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he's become my salvation. He's my God. I will prepare him a habitation, my father's God, and I will exalt him." Well, that's a very familiar story about the wars of the Lord and passing through the Red Sea and all of that. It used to be that every Easter Sunday, we would come home and watch this Exodus movie that was great, the Ten Commandments movie. And his name, Charlton Heston, is that right? He was Moses. And even then, when they cross through the sea and they're playing the dramatic music, like, wow, that's cool. How did they do that? What was that like? And it is a big deal, not just in cinema history, but in human history. This is the pivotal moment in Israeli history, because the miracle of the Red Sea is talked about at least 25 times in the Bible. It comes up all the time. And the Passover Red Sea crossing is what made Israel a nation, a for real nation, and not just a big family. Once that happened, now we're going to be off to the races. We have a population. We're going to give them a land, a promised land. We're going to give them a constitution. That's going to be the Ten Commandments, the Mosaic Law. This is the beginning of turning a family into a for real nation. And what the Passover Red Sea crossing means to Israel is what the resurrection means to Christians. That is, once they crossed the Red Sea, they went a couple months down the road and had the Ten Commandments. And so it was the beginning of a covenant. Same as when Jesus rose from death, it was the beginning of a new covenant. So the old Mosaic covenant, the Old Testament, and the New Testament are the Red Sea and the resurrection, basically. In both cases, we're associated with 3 days. We know that after the escape from Egypt, the Jewish people had three places they camped. These places are a little hard to identify today for us, but they had three places they camped. It's possible they stayed more than one night at any or all of those encampments. But we know that they had three. So we think, and Moses told Pharaoh, we want to go 3 days into the wilderness and worship our God. So we have this association of 3 days with the Red Sea crossing. We have the association of 3 days with the resurrection. So a lot of similar things. And in both cases, you have this historical reality. Like it seems in ancient times, nobody really doubted that the Red Sea crossing occurred. And in our time, we have pretty strong evidence that the resurrection occurred. It's just a historical thing. It happened, and there's nothing you can do about it. And in both cases, you had, for Israel, the bedrock assurance that everything's going to be okay. After all, God fights for us. And in the New Testament, everything's going to be okay because, after all, we have a resurrected Savior who fights for us. There are so many lessons in the Red Sea crossing. I know you can't even see this very well, but I just wanted to make an impression. There are so many lessons. For example, Pharaoh is a picture of Satan. Egypt is a picture of the world. The Exodus is a picture of salvation, and baptism is even mentioned along those lines in 1 Corinthians 10:2. The Exodus is a picture of victory in your daily spiritual warfare against the devil. It's also a picture of your daily spiritual warfare against temptation. And so deliver us from evil is in the Lord's Prayer. And by the way, Satan never quits pursuing, so it's always appropriate to pray, deliver us from evil. The pillar of fire is a picture of Jesus, who is the light in a dark world because it's nighttime and the Israelites pass through under the light of the pillar of fire. The same God who is a light to one class of people, the Jewish people, is hated by the others. He was a dark cloud. They didn't like it. This is a picture of deliverance then from hell, from the world, the flesh, and the devil. And it's by a miracle. And the only way any of us are going to have deliverance is through God's intervention. There is usually a Red Sea for you to cross if you want to see God's promises. You'll have to have faith and cross the Red Sea. It is inevitable that we will someday be up against a wall, in this case, up against the sea. We're trapped and we can't get away. And that's going to be part of your life experience. And lastly, this is, as I said, like the resurrection to Christians. You have the Red Sea to the Jewish faith of the Old Testament. All right, but here's what we're going to look at today. Just three lessons, so important. The first thing we're going to highlight, that they were trapped by the sea. And the way Pharaoh considered it, they were entangled in the land. Now they're in trouble. We've got them pinned down. We're going to go after them and destroy them. And then we're going to talk about the affliction, the cries, the sorrow that are associated with this event and with all human life. And then we're going to talk about when there's nothing to do but stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Remember, here's the storyline just in case you're not entirely familiar. The family of Jacob went to Egypt because there was no food in Israel, and there was food in Egypt. They met Joseph, of course, and then the family of Jacob stayed there for 400 years, most of which they were bullied as slaves. Moses returns in the 1400s BC with 10 plagues, particularly the Passover plague. And it was on Passover night that the children of Israel fled Egypt. And then we realize that the Israelites flee southeast, and they are directed. They're not just guessing where to go. They are directed by the pillar of cloud, pillar of fire. And they have three places they camp, and then they're pinned up against the Red Sea. And that's how the story goes. So again, in chapter 14, as it starts, there's this idea of being tangled up, trapped in the land. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Turn and encamp by the sea, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, 'They're entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart that he shall follow after them.'" It is inevitable that there will be times in your life and your spiritual warfare when you are trapped. You are entangled in the land. You are the person who is shut in by wilderness. You're stuck. And this is going to happen to you in your life. You can't avoid this. You might be stuck, trapped by a health problem. You might be trapped by an insurmountable money problem. You just can't solve this. You might be trapped by somebody's betrayal. This breaks your heart. You are stuck, and there's not one thing you can do about it. And this happens, and it is in the case of Satan. He never stops pursuing. Not that Satan is your only problem, because you have Satan and the world and the flesh. But Satan is a big problem. And remember, Pharaoh is a picture of Satan. And what we find is that Pharaoh lets him go for a time and chases him again. And you know what? Satan will let you go for a time, and he's going to chase you down again. And you can take that to the bank. One girl in Colorado wrote to Merrill Unger, and she said, "At 17, I married a boy from school who was not a Christian. My life became miserable, and I started to drink. At 22 years old, I asked God to forgive me for living in awful sin, and I rededicated my life to Christ. The very next morning, I awoke terribly afraid. I had a terrifying urge to take my own life. Awful fear hounded me when I attempted to read the scripture or pray. I could take this torture for only about 5 or 6 days, and then you know what I would do, or rather be compelled to do? I would get drunk." So she's trying to live for the Lord. And she says, you know, she gave her heart to Jesus freshly. "I just want to live for you, Lord." And the very next day, she's this terror. You know, you can't put your finger on it. Like, what's the cause? Why are you so upset? "I don't know. I just have terror." And she wanted to take her own life. And she would put up with it as long as she could and then go get drunk to ease the pain. Notice, Satan always pursues again. Just when you thought, hey, I'm going to get my life together and follow Jesus, Pharaoh says no, hooks up the horses and chariots, and chases you down. That's the way it is in spiritual warfare. Beverly had only been saved for a few months out of heroin addiction. And interestingly, again, says Merrill Unger, these frightening seizures that would leave her in an unconscious state. And by the way, they said her eyes had a strange glow when this happened. And sometimes she would bark like a dog, or hiss like a snake, or cackle like a hyena. It was just bizarre and frightening. And of course, it was frightening to her. Interestingly, the seizures were never particularly noteworthy. Until when? Until she became a Christian. And then they became more violent still when Beverly was adopted into a really fine Christian home. You see, you think, all right, I got away from Egypt. I'm not going to be in the world like that anymore. I'm giving my heart to Jesus and everything is going to be better. Well, it's true. Everything is going to be better. But you can't think that Pharaoh's not going to hook up the chariot and pursue you again, because he will. And he'll do it when you're 20 years old, when you're 50 years old, and until the day you die. He is tenacious. He will not quit. And you have to brace for that. Dave Dravecki was trapped in the wilderness, up against the wall, when he, as a professional baseball player and a lover of God, could not recover from his cancer and had to have his arm amputated. And he says, what do you do when no matter how hard you try, things will never return to the way they were? What do you do when you can't change the circumstances of your life? What do you do when you can't come back? I always thought that was just so dramatic and so sad. What do you do when you can't come back? You realize, you know, you have this dream and your dream is dashed and it's never going to come to pass. Then what do? You're trapped. You know, you're up against the Red Sea. What are you going to do? Very often in life, humanly speaking, there isn't any hope. Well, that causes tears. It causes sorrow. You feel terrible when your dreams are dashed, when you're up against the Red Sea and you don't know what to do and everything looks so awful, then you get emotional. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. This is at the burning bush, and they've been in bondage. They've been in a hard world of bondage, in this case, for almost 400 years. I've seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them out of that land unto a good land and a large land, a land flowing with milk and honey. That's the way it's going to be. And so the Lord is going to get involved with these people because there have been tears and sorrows and afflictions. And so he's going to take matters into his hands. Well, the Lord has to do that for all of us because we live in a really bad world. This is an excerpt from a survivor of the Titanic. And he was talking about what it felt like when the Titanic was going to sink. He said, when these people who were in the steerage, not good cabins for the trip, these are relatively poor people. When these people in steerage got on deck, they found that there was danger, like the ship is in trouble. One or two of the women began to cry, and a panic began to spread. The officer who was standing at the rope had a pistol in his hand, and he ordered everybody to keep back. First one woman screamed, and then another, and then one man pushed toward the boat, and the officer fired at him. So they actually had to use, you know, gunshots to keep people in line. And everybody's upset. The world is hard. You do not live in an easy place. Planet Earth is a scary place. It's a hostile place. And you should never be surprised when living in this hostile place, there are afflictions. Life is hard, and you'll want the Lord to help you with life. Some years back, a man was going through a very poor area, a very poor neighborhood, and he's a Christian man. He's just reaching out to people and trying to be helpful. He sees a ladder going up into an attic of an abandoned house. So he thought, I'm just going to climb this ladder and see what's happening up here. He gets up there, and there's a little boy there. Not a little boy. He's about 12 years old. And he's hiding in the attic. So the man asks, son, what are you doing here? He says, don't tell anybody, sir. I'm hiding. Look here. He pulled up his shirt. And there was terrible bruising, like frightening bruising. Something is wrong with this boy. His abdomen is just all black and blue. And the Christian says, who beat you like that? He said, father did, sir, because I wouldn't steal. So his father was making the boy steal. This happens to be Father's Day. Here's what I'm supposed to remind you, that there's something awful about being betrayed by a father, because the father was put in the family to be the hero. And when the father is not the hero, when the father is not the provider and the protector, there's just something in all of nature that says this is so wrong. The way the Bible talks about it from time to time is that there is no natural affection. It's interesting, in American and British law, there was this idea, of course, the Bible's ideas had so much impact on the laws of the United States. And from time to time, there were these instances that came to court when an apprentice was beaten by his employer, and the case went to court. And the judges often said the apprentice cannot be beaten by his employer, as if the employer is assuming the role of a father. Because when a father disciplines his child, he has, and they use this term in American law, when a father disciplines his child, he has natural affection. But when an employer beats an apprentice, there is no natural affection. And it's being done in a bad spirit. It's being overdone and exaggerated. And so in the courts of early America, they recognize the difference between being disciplined with natural affection and without it. There's something awful about when a person is supposed to have natural affection for his children and he doesn't. The Bible considers this to be a terrible sin, a horror to see. They are so bad that they are without natural affection. Fathers, you have an obligation to be the provider and the protector, and I hope you'll take that seriously. Who beat you like that? Father did, sir, because I wouldn't steal. Well, did you ever steal? Yes, sir, but I went to the mission school. That's what they called Sunday schools about 120 years ago. I went to Sunday school, and they told me there of God and of heaven and of Jesus, and they taught me, thou shalt not steal, and I'll never steal again. if Father kills me for it. And then he says, would you like to hear a little hymn they taught me? So the man said, sure. And the kids sang, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, look upon a little child in the kingdom of thy grace. Give a little child a place. The man said, you have to stay here. I know a lady. I'm going to get something better for you. Stay here and wait for me. And when the man came back, less than 2 hours later, the kid was dead. We live in a bad world. Sometimes fathers don't do what they're supposed to do. Sometimes the people you're counting on don't come through. Hearts are broken. People die. People get sick. Money is sometimes impossible to find. We live in a hard world. And so there's affliction and crying and sorrows, and you need the Lord. Eugenia Price wasn't beaten as a child, but the world was still hard. Even though she was rather affluent, here's what she said before she found the Lord in a hard world like Egypt. This is what it's like. One day I sat alone on the front steps and almost realized that nothing really mattered in my whole life enough to bother to write it down. That's a problem because she's a professional writer here in New England and she didn't have anything to say. So I had nothing whatever to say. I was heavy. Things were heavy for me. I blamed life and I hated myself heavily. Self-deception is very, very heavy. And fear is very, very heavy. And worry is very, very heavy. The heaviest thing of all is to have no beginning and no end, no alpha and no omega. All of life was a burden, a very heavy burden. And so in a bad world, a world that is like Egypt, a bad world, we need the Lord to help us. Besides the great deliverance the Lord gives us from sin, death, and hell, you know, our salvation itself, there are 10,000 other lesser deliverances that he gives us. I'd like to remind you how many afflictions there are, how many sorrows there are all around us right here in affluent America. Remember, 1 out of 5 Americans are living with a diagnosable form of mental illness right now. 1 out of 5 American adults are taking mood-altering prescriptions right now. A lot of afflictions and sorrows and crying. 1 out of 10 Americans have undergone treatment for depression. Antidepressants are the most prescribed drugs in America for young adults. Maybe 1 out of every 10 Americans has had such a terrifying trauma in his life somewhere along the line to be diagnosed, formally diagnosed with PTSD. Generation Z, those are the kids born from 1995 until now. They are now, you know, old enough for us to see their, you know, trends. They suffer from higher rates of anxiety and depression than did millennials, and higher rates of suicide. From 2010 to 2016, not so long ago, the earliest, most recent research, evidence from hard data of emergency room visits, right? So they're not self-reporting, they're going to the emergency room. Evidence from emergency room visits indicates that these college students suffer substantial increases in emergency room visits for suicide attempts, for self-injury and suicidal ideation. We are crying. We are afflicted. There are sorrows in this land of Egypt where we live, and we need the Lord. So sometimes you're trapped. You're up against something terrible, and you can't survive it. There's affliction. There's cries, there's sorrow everywhere you go. What are we going to do? And sometimes there is literally nothing to do but stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. That's what Moses told the people. Chapter 14 of Exodus, verse 13. Moses said to the people, fear not, stand still, see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians whom you've seen today, you'll see them again no more forever. And the Lord shall fight for you and you shall hold your peace. A lot of times the Lord does give us responsibilities. When we talk about some of the other wars of the Lord, we're going to talk about the part we play. But this war of the Lord is special because this time there's literally nothing the people can do. There's nothing they can do. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. That's what we do when we come to Jesus in the first place. There's nothing to do at Calvary for our salvation except to see the Lord hanging on the cross in our spiritual minds, to see the Lord hanging on the cross and to appreciate what he's doing. There's nothing for us to add to the cross. In Psalm 51, this is after David has sinned with Bathsheba, and of course he hates himself. And so he writes this psalm, and he says, "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions with ink," you know, scribble them out. "Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin, for I acknowledge my transgressions." It's true, I'm awful. "I acknowledge my transgressions. My sin is ever before me. I think about it all the time. I never stop thinking about it. Against you and you only have I sinned." Like, yeah, it was against Bathsheba. It was against Uriah. But most of all, it's against you, because now your son has to die on the cross to pay for that sin. So you're the one I mostly sin against. Verse 16. "You do not desire a sacrifice, else I would give it." I mean, if there was something to do, I would do it. But there's nothing for me to do. If you wanted a sacrifice, I'd bring it. But there isn't. In Numbers 21, this is when the people have been complaining out in the wilderness, and the Lord sent fiery serpents, some kind of red snake, to bite them. The Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and many people died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, "Pray to the Lord that he might take away the serpents from us." And the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole. It shall come to pass that everyone who is bitten when he looks upon it shall live." And Moses made a serpent of brass. He put it on a pole. And if a serpent had bitten any man when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. That's your salvation. There's not one thing you can do for your salvation except look. Look and live. You look at the cross of Jesus and the snake bite is healed. Sin is gone. Well, and besides that great deliverance from sin, death, and hell, there are 10,000 other moments in your life when God alone can deliver you. When you are up against the Red Sea, you're trapped, and there's not one thing you can do. There are these lucky breaks in Scripture, right? And you have these in your life. For example, a ram was tangled up in a dense clump of bushes when Isaac was spared. What's the likelihood that when you need a sacrifice, there's going to be one tangled up in the bushes, right? Lucky breaks. Eliezer is sent to find a wife for Isaac. He meets Rebecca the moment he arrives at the well. He meets the girl who is going to eventually become Isaac's wife in this matchmaking endeavor. What's the likelihood of that? She's going to be the first one he sees. An Egyptian princess found and loved Moses when he was a baby, and all of the Israelite babies were being killed in those days by the Egyptians. What's the likelihood that a princess is going to care about this baby? Well, she does. Boaz encounters Ruth and loves her from the very start. What's the likelihood of that? You go from a nobody, Ruth, having no options, to meeting a wealthy guy who says, "I love you. You want to be my wife?" What's the likelihood of that? And by the way, not only was he wealthy, he's a wonderful person. Nabal fell over dead when he might have made trouble for David and Abigail. So his heart turned to stone, had a heart attack, and quit beating just like that. There's no more trouble. What's the likelihood of that? Lucky breaks. Ahasuerus read about Mordecai's heroism on the very night when Haman was building his gallows. What's the likelihood of that? Lucky break. The Good Samaritan traveled on that fateful day. He stopped and helped the man who was robbed and beaten and left for dead. What's the likelihood that they're going to meet? We have little things like that that happen in our lives, right? When we wanted to build the gym, I really wanted it right from the start because it would be so good for children's ministries, teen ministries, all those things. And I went to the banker one day, and the banker said, "You know, your church just isn't there. You just don't have enough money. Come back and see me when you have a lot more money." And we never had a lot more money, but one day I decided just to go back and check again. And what had happened is the loan officer that told us no went to a different position. So now there's a new loan officer, and his name was Rob Ritchie. And as soon as I talked to him, I liked him. I said, "We want to build a gym." And he didn't tell me no. And then he came and he started looking at it. And he came to Rod and me and said, well, you know, you're not exactly there. But I went to my boss and I said, I really want to make this work. And the boss said, okay, but if it fails, it's on you. It's your career. And Rob said, okay. So we got to have our gym. For a number of years, we had our church services in there. That gym was everything. We set it up for this thing and then tear it down and set it up for another thing and tear it down. And he's constantly moving chairs and tables and whatever needed to be done and platforms that would fall out of the, you know, side. And it was so necessary. It was just a lucky break. I mean, the loan officer changed and this one was a Christian guy who just said, okay, I'll do it. Like, lucky breaks. One fellow named Aram wrote to Philip Yancey, author, and he was talking about being a kid, and he was shoveling snow for this lady, a widow lady. She was 80 years old, and her name was Mrs. Back. And she couldn't shovel her own snow, of course, so he did it to make money. And what he wanted to do was shovel the snow, get his money, and get home or get to somebody else's, you know, snow to shovel. He didn't want to hang out with an 80-year-old widow. Well, but she was watching for him, right? So he finished shoveling and she says, now you have to come inside and have apple pie. And she's not offering him money yet, right? So he kind of has to do it because she's lonely and she wants to talk. And so in he goes. And he scarfs down this apple pie and she moves very slowly. So she sits down with hers and his is already gone. And she says, okay, I'll get you another one. So, and doesn't give him a chance to say, no, I really have to go or something. He says, it's amazing how quickly she moved on that occasion when she wanted him to stay. She comes back with another pie, piece of pie, and she sits down. And he says, even at that young age, he's about 12 years old. Even at that young age, I began to reflect, how could someone be so oblivious to the cues before her? How could she not notice that I wanted out of there? And yet, that's the way it was. So now you have to fast forward about 10 years. And Aram has become a Christian in his college years. And about 3 days after he becomes a Christian, the thought occurs to him, I really need to tell Miss Back that I'm a believer. He felt like I had to tell her, like I needed to. Something was compelling me to. So he goes back, and she's 90 years old now. And he finds her. She's actually in the yard doing something with her flowers, which is great. So Mrs. Back, do you know what it means to be born again? And she dropped everything and looked at me in sheer surprise and delight and said, why, yes, I do. And she was so delighted. So 90 years old, right? Said, stay right here. She totters into her house. She comes out with a chocolate cake. And she says, here, eat this. And she's just so happy and everything. And in the course of that conversation, she says, you know, for the last 15 years since you moved in, I've prayed every day for you and for Paul, the neighbor on the other side. And for Paul, I prayed every day that you would come to know Jesus. Is that great? For 15 years. I mean, there's not one thing you can do. I mean, I tried apple pie. It didn't work. I'm done. What else can I do? There's nothing else to do. Moses said, from now on, just stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. It's on God's hands now. It's nothing more to try. Some of you know this story from the Kuthrals, a missionary family that many of you know. They work in Pakistan. And in the summer of 2002, some Al-Qaeda terrorists attacked the school, the Christian school, there in Pakistan. And as the terrorists came in, two guards were shot immediately. By the time anybody understood what was happening and they started to lock up the building, it was really out of hand. And these were suicide terrorists. They meant to shoot as many people as they could. There were about 100 students and staffers present that day, even though it was a holiday time. They said 100 Christians in this school, and Al-Qaeda terrorists were determined to kill them. That was the point. And one of the mothers isn't usually at the school, but she was there that day, and she actually did get shot in the hand, but she said she was running down the hallways and bullets are whizzing past her. They're touching her hair. And she one time put her hands over her head because she hears these bullets whizzing around her head. And a bullet hit her in the hand. And she said there was a Pakistani fellow, also armed, who was smiling at her reassuringly as she went and showing her where to go. And what you have to know is that no Pakistani man would ever smile reassuringly at a Christian woman under any circumstances, and there should have been no such person there. But anyway, while the kids are hiding, now all the doors are locked down, while the kids are hiding, they start to hear voices in the attic. And not just voices, but singing. So one eighth grader, her name is Becca, she said it was faint at first, and then it became clearer. It was while the shooting was still going on. And I thought, somebody put a tape or a CD on to calm us down. And the song was, "Our God is an awesome God." She says, it was really nice choir music coming from the rafters. And when the day was over, I told my friends, and they said they heard it too. But nobody's playing music. There's nobody in the attic. And she says, that's why I know there were angels in the rafters. You see, you're up against the Red Sea. You've done what you can do, right? You've locked the doors. You're hiding. You've run. You've done what you can do. And there's not one thing more to try. And so the word is, just stand fast and see the salvation of the Lord. I'm going to close with this story, and I love this. This is not even a true story. I usually tell you true stories. It's kind of important to me to tell you true stories. This is definitely not a true story. This is a false story, but it's been written in poem form, and it teaches such a deep and theologically correct lesson that I love this story, even though it's kind of crazy. So it comes from Tuscany, Italy. A woman was so sick that she was dying. The doctor said, "You have to send for your husband. He is away at the time. If he wants to see you again in this world, you have to send for him to come back. But it would take a messenger a couple of days to get to the husband, and then it would take the husband a couple of days to get back from his travels." And so the messenger was sent. In the meantime, a woman, Marianne, was sent to try to nurse this woman back to health. Marianne prayed so fervently that this woman would get better. And she tended to her so nurturingly. And sure enough, the woman did get better. That was such a joy. But Marianne realized that the scales could tip back the other direction at any time. And not only was this a young mother, just had a baby, and that was why she was sick. She didn't do well in childbearing. She had to take care of the baby and had to keep the mom going so that the baby could be well. And there's such a lot of stress and pressure. And she said, "I have to make a good soup for her. She needs her health now. It could get out of hand again in a moment." But the problem is she'd already been awake 2 or 3 days trying to take care of this woman and the baby. And she was so tired. And in those days, you had a wood stove. So she has to keep adding fuel to the fire and adding ingredients to the soup and watching it and keeping it all going. And she was so tired, she just couldn't stay awake. She tried, and it was so important to her. It was her absolute priority, but she just couldn't stay awake. And she fueled the fire, and then she fell asleep in her chair. She didn't mean to, but she did. When she woke up, she realized that somebody had added more fuel to the fire, and the soup was done, and done to perfection. So the last lines of the story, and I love these last lines. When her willing hands were weary, when her tender eyes were closed, the Lord finished all she failed in. He watched while she reposed. We are all failures, you know. And we get up against a Red Sea, and we can't win. How are you supposed to win? We can't survive this. But what if we have a God who will finish what we fail in. Who will work when we're so weary we can't work anymore. And that's the Red Sea. When you get trapped against a Red Sea in your life, and there will be Red Seas in your life, and realistically, you can't win, you can't do it, you have to remember that you're following a God who is so wonderful that he finishes everything you fail in. That's good, that's worth doing. He finishes and he works when you collapse. So you just have to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, because in this spiritual warfare, that's a real thing. Let's stand and be dismissed with prayer. Well, Father, I pray that you'll help us all to see that when there's nothing left to do, when we're completely outnumbered and outgunned, when we're trapped and tangled, and there's nothing humanly possible, that we have followed a great God who will finish where we fail and who will work when we collapse. I pray that we'll see it and we'll feel it and we'll love you for it today in Jesus' name. Amen.